Welcome to How Leaders Lead, where every week you get to listen in while I interview some of the very best leaders in the world. I break down the key learnings so that by the end of the episode, you'll have something simple you can apply as you develop into a better leader. That's what this podcast is all about. Well, today is our always popular Best Of episode, where we'll play for you some of the best insights from our episodes the past few months. And I'm joined by my co-host, Kula Callahan. Hey, Kula, how you doing today?
David, I'm doing great. I'm so happy to be back here recording this episode with you. And if this is your first Best of the Quarter episode, welcome. I'm so glad you're here and tuning in. David, as you mentioned, we've pulled one of our favorite clips from each of the guests this quarter. And we've had some incredible guests this quarter. So buckle up because you're about to get a ton of leadership wisdom in just a short amount of time. Before we get started, though, there's something I want you to do. You can keep this episode playing in the background, but I want you to head over to the App Store and download our brand new app called How Leaders Lead. This iPhone app is free, and every day we serve up a brand new leadership insight like you're about to hear in this episode. It's a 1 to 2 minute leadership devotional, if you will, and it's designed to help you become a better leader. So start a leadership habit and watch that daily leadership insight each and every morning. I guarantee it'll level up your leadership game and keep you inspired each and every day. So now that you've downloaded the app, let's get started with the Best of Quarter One episode. David, it's always interesting to me to hear how people respond to challenges and adversity. So as we kick things off on this Best Of episode, here's a clip from Brian Nickel, the CEO of Chipotle. Brian says you can't learn from mistakes if you beat yourself up over them. So let's take a listen to your interview with Brian from episode 168.
We did something a year ago. It was called Garlic Guajillo Steak. You know, this is a great case of we didn't actually roll out what we tested. So when we tested it, it was at a certain price point. All that inflation hit, so on and so forth. We ended up rolling it out anyway, and we just raised the price higher than what we tested it at. And it didn't perform. We had some trepidation on the name because garlic guajillo steak, say that 3 times. And it was hard.
I was pretty impressed when you did it the first time. I'm saying, I don't think I could have launched that product. I'd never pronounce it.
Yeah, well, and we saw it too. It was funny, like when we launched it, this was kind of an interesting learning. People were having problems searching it on the web. So like one of the things, like carne asada, bang. People have no problem searching for carne asada. Garlic guajillo steak, a little bit harder. And so look, we learned from it. We're like, look, the product tasted great, but we priced it incorrectly and we probably named it incorrectly. And as a result, it didn't perform as well as it should have. And we've learned from it. You know, it's like, we won't do that again. And as a matter of fact, even today, we were just doing a little post-mortem on this of like, why do you think carne asada this year is outperforming garlic guajillo steak so much? And I think this is a hopefully a part of my leadership style, which is, look, it wasn't as successful as we wanted to, but we don't have to beat each other up over it. We can learn from it so that we're better the next time. And I think we are a hell of a lot better with this carne asada because we learned from that garlic guajillo steak initiative.
It's not often that I meet a coach or a leader with as much intensity and focus as Dan Hurley has. Dan won a national championship with his UConn Huskies last season, and as you're about to hear in this clip, Dan pours absolutely everything into being the best coach he can be. Maybe that's why they're a number one seed this year as March Madness takes off. Something I learned about Dan prepping for a conversation is that he was a highly recruited basketball player himself. But unfortunately, he didn't feel like he played up to his potential. And something you're about to hear is how he used that disappointment as fuel. This is from episode 169.
For me, Dave, I blew it at the college level as a player. It haunts me from time to time. As a high school player, I was a top flight prospect, and I was a really talented player that didn't apply himself in every way at the college level and did not play up to my abilities. I let, you know, my college teammates down. I let my organization down. I let the coaching staff that invested in me down as a player. I think about that a lot because I'm involved in basketball. It's, I'm not a lawyer. I think that part of my life is closed. So I think now, though, Dave, I overpour into my coaching. It's like I know I could have did more, and now I'm going to make up for it in my career as a coach in terms of just pouring everything that I have into that. And, you know, I give all of my energy into this, my leadership, my coaching, UConn basketball, and into my family. And then I don't have a whole lot of time for much else.
Well, David, while we're talking about basketball coaches, just last week we aired your conversation with Matt Doherty. Back in 1982, Matt won a national championship as a player at North Carolina alongside Michael Jordan and James Worthy. Years later, he became the head basketball coach at Notre Dame and then returned to his alma mater as head coach of the Tar Heels. There was a story from that episode I thought was so good, and the big idea is that if you want to drive performance, you have to hold your people accountable. Let's take a listen to this clip from episode 179.
And you got off to a flying start because your very first game was against Ohio State, which happened to be ranked fifth in the country at the time, and you won. You know, how'd you celebrate with your players after a big win like that?
Well, take a step back. 5 days prior, we had played an exhibition game against a team called Marathon Oil. Now, a lot of teams were put together and sponsored by different companies, and one was Marathon Oil, and they would go around and play, get former college players and play against college teams, and you were allowed two exhibition games before the season started. Ohio State had played Marathon Oil, I think, the night before us and beat them by 25. We played them and lost by 25. And the next day, we're supposed to have off. And I look at the paper, and the paper in the South Bend Tribune reads, you know, the subtitle was "The Lackadaisical Effort Dooms the Irish." My body started to get warm. And then hot, and smoke was coming out of my ears. So I said to my coaches, I said, "We're going to have practice today, but no basketballs." And so the players showed up, and I said, "You know, guys, I've been called a lot of things, but, you know, lackadaisical is not one of them." I said, "We're going to play hard." I use coaches' core values: play hard, play smart, play together. And I said, that wasn't it. I had raised $1 million to get a new locker room. I said, I raised $1 million for you guys. I said, I spend more time with you guys than my family. I did make it personal. I said, "You're going to give me that? You're going to give us that?" No, on the baseline. And they ran sprints, and they ran sprints, and they ran sprints, and they ran some more sprints, and to the point where some guys were falling out, and I said, "Fine, get out. You know, you're not tough enough. Get out." And we ran for about, I don't know, an hour. Finally, I was done with them. They didn't like me. I didn't like them. 5 days later, we go into Columbus, Ohio, beat number 5 Ohio State, on the last second shot. I'm getting goosebumps talking about it right now. Went into the locker room. I remember talking to Bill Raftery after the game with my son in my arm on ESPN. And there in the locker room, they came out into the hallway to greet me. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing about sports. You know, you get high highs, you know, you get some low lows, but those moments, very special. And the players then, we had a bus ride about whatever it was back to South Bend. When they got to the locker room, they wrote 304 on the whiteboard. Well, 304 apparently, by their calculation, was the number of sprints they ran. And so that was kind of our calling card the rest of the year. They put it on their sneakers. We talk about 304, 304. Like, if we can do that, we've got enough in the tank to play hard tonight. And I love coaching that team. I love coaching Notre Dame. And in some ways, I wish I stayed there forever.
You know, Kula, back when I was CEO at Yum, I had the great opportunity to work alongside Alwyn Lewis, who was my chief operating officer. Let me tell you, Alwyn is one incredible leader. Something I always appreciated about Alwyn was his drive for results. And in this clip you're about to hear, he talks about what's possible if you make driving for results a cornerstone of your leadership. This is from episode 174.
I'm a manager for the first time. I'm really running a country club for for about the first 6 weeks. I'm doing tasks for everybody. I'm their friends. I'm a bleeding heart liberal. I'm just trying to please everybody. So my district manager comes in and shows me a P&L for the first time. And he's like, we're losing money. Your food cost is 5% over. Your labor cost is 5% over. You're minus 15 in the hole from your profit and loss. That was startling to me. And then he's like, you know, you got people stealing from you and they're taking advantage of you. And that just shook up. It's like, you know, this is not fun. It can be an enjoyable environment, but we're here for a reason and we're here to make money. And so that created this whole sense of how do you make money the right way through people and do it in a way that you can teach people because you need help, but you can't run away from results. And the results are the currency you use to say, I deserve to be promoted. I deserve that raise. I deserve to come back to work the next day. Without results, nothing's possible. We're not running a nonprofit business. Those are important. But the frame of our business is, how do I make money so I can afford to reinvest, so I can afford to hire more people, so I can afford to have resources so I can do service well and maintenance well? And so that was a very important lesson after those first 6 weeks of saying, oh, I'm everybody's friend. I'm running a country club too. Oh, no, we got to have standards. We got to have procedures because we need to make money. And then, you know, coming to work for Jack in the Box and PepsiCo, those organizations that if you didn't make plan, you were not going to be around. And so the notion of how do you make money, do it the right way, but do it over and over again became very important. You could do it by accident once, but you know, my goal was always out of a 13 period year, can we blow away plan 12 out of 13 so we can have an excellent year? You're always going to have one that's kind of unexpected.
This next clip is with Lisa Lutoff-Perlo, the former CEO of Celebrity Cruises. As we're all navigating our own career journeys, it's easy to get tunnel vision and be solely focused on what our goals are, the things that we want to accomplish. But I love how Lisa has shifted her mindset from me to we as she climbed the ranks to become the CEO of Celebrity Cruises in a male-dominated industry. Of course, she worked really hard to get into that position, but she quickly used her own success to pave the way for others. This is something that all of us can do as leaders. So take a listen to this excerpt from episode 172.
Yeah, well, I did have a big move. I figured it was about 6 months into my tenure as president and CEO. And I knew, you know, a lot of people ask me, how does it feel to have achieved what you achieved in accomplishing, you know, being the CEO of one of the brands? And I'd be lying if I didn't say that it was great. It was a major accomplishment and it was something I never dreamed that would happen for me. But I think the real thing for me isn't so much about me, because sure, I made it. It's wonderful. It's great. I worked really hard. I earned everything I got. But the biggest thing for me was bringing others along with me in an industry that was woefully short of women. And there was, you know, the gender imbalance was staggering. So the first big move that I made was appointing the first woman captain for Celebrity and the first and still only American woman ever to be the captain of a mega cruise ship, Captain Kate McHugh. That was the start. That was the first big move. And then at that time, 3% of the women on our bridges were women. And by the time I stepped down from Celebrity in April of 2023, 33%. Of the crew members on our bridges were women. And I did that with the help of men that I worked with who were equally passionate about more gender equality on our bridges. And I give them a tremendous amount of credit for helping get us there.
Well, Kula, continuing on with that theme, this next clip is from our friend Tim Scherer. Tim is the CEO of David Novak Leadership, and something Tim talks about a lot is that success comes from helping others. Here's a clip from my conversation with Tim in episode 175.
So I'm sure everyone listening knows the story of Apollo 11. You know, you've got Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. But what a lot of people don't know, there's a third astronaut on that mission, and his name was Michael Collins. So Michael Collins is actually the guy that Ubered Neil and Buzz to the moon. So he drops them off so those guys can do all the things that they had to do on the moon's surface. Well, he actually stayed back in the command module and orbited the moon something like 26 times until those guys are ready to be picked up and brought back to Earth. But what I love about Michael Collins is that when he got back to Earth and sat down with the press, he talked about how content he was to have had one of those three seats. He was just happy to be part of the mission. And Michael is such a rarity because it just feels like in the world we live in today, if you want to be successful, you have to step into the spotlight. You have to have fame and money and power. But the secret society of success operates very differently. They show up in the world very differently. And if there's a common denominator for what it means to be in the secret society of success, I'd say it's this idea of helping others win. David, what I appreciate so much about your leadership is when you were running Yum, you had 1.5 million employees. It would have been so easy for you to make it all about you, but you didn't do that. I just feel like you use your position to serve more people.
The week of the Super Bowl, we aired your conversation with Lynn Swann. He's an NFL Hall of Famer who won four Super Bowls with the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 70s. Safe to say, Lynn has been part of some remarkable high-performing teams. And what you're about to hear in this clip is how strong teams value everyone's contribution. You might not be the one throwing the pass or scoring the touchdown, but every person on the team has to play their part if they want the team to win. This clip is from episode 173.
It's that trust, again, that your teammates have in you. And it's doing a job, even if you're not scoring or you're not making a big play, but you're contributing to create an opportunity for your team to win and make the big play. So we've already talked about the AFC Championship game in Oakland, getting to our first Super Bowl. We play the Vikings. We win. I call the play. It gets us to the Super Bowl. How many passes did Chuck or the offense throw to me in that first Super Bowl? Super Bowl IX. Zero. Not a single pass, not a play called to me in the entire game. And I played the entire game. But what I did do was run my route, block the guys, all the things I needed to get done to help the team to kind of move it forward. So when the game's over, and the owner of the team, Art Rooney Sr., is in the locker room, tears coming down his eyes, and Pete Rozelle handing him the Vince Lombardi trophy. And Pittsburgh has climbed that mountain to win the very first Super Bowl in their long history. I felt as excited and as jubilant as anybody in the room because I'm a part of that team. We all contributed some way, somehow, at practice, getting us there and making sure we won the ball game. And so when you're a part of that team, everything the team does, you feel like you had some part of it.
So I've got a question for you. Do you have anyone on your team that's willing to tell you when you're wrong about something? Because let me tell you, we all need truth tellers in our lives. And this next clip serves as a great reminder of that. It's with Admiral Mike Mullen, the 17th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Admiral Mullen would advise the president on any decision being made when it came to national security. And as you can probably imagine, having to be a truth teller to the president of the United States is no small order. This clip is from episode 170.
If you can imagine, and I tell this story about, there's this little ante room outside the Oval Office. And I watched a lot of people that were going to, you know, be very strong with the president about telling him something. I used to describe it as that famous door into the Oval Office. What nobody knows is above that door is, you know, Tinkerbell. And as soon as you walk in there, Tinkerbell hits you with the gold dust and you're just not as tough as you thought you were to tell the most powerful person in the world, here's exactly where it stands. So I know that's a challenge. I think all leaders have to have, you know, people around them, usually at least one, if not a couple, who will close the door and say, hey, you got this exactly wrong. And I was blessed to have a guy named John Kirby, who was my public affairs officer for 10 years and is now in the National Security Council. You see him frequently in the Biden administration. But when he was in uniform with me, he's the one that would close the door and say, you got that completely wrong. And I expected that. That's never easy medicine to take, but it was really important medicine to have. And it was him. I had actually two or three that would do that fairly routinely. And I had a very diverse group of advisors, which I depended on, one, for that truth, and two, for different opinions. I feel very strongly that for major decisions, the more diverse views I have as a leader, the better decision I'm going to make, you know, when it comes down to the really, really tough consequential decisions.
Michelle Korsmo is the president and CEO of the National Restaurant Association. And in support of the restaurant industry, she works with all kinds of people, including nearly a million restaurateurs, a huge board with over 100 members, and the United States Congress. And trying to serve so many different parties, it's no surprise that things don't always go as planned. Here's a little clip from episode 177, where Michelle shares her take on what to do when you make bad decisions.
When I make wrong decisions, and I do, as we all do, the best thing to do is always to really focus in on the fact that that decision was wrong, and then to pivot and figure out what the right decision is and change and go in that direction. Because what I found is, especially in my work in advocacy, making the wrong decision isn't fatal, but not doing something about it could be. And so I think that for me, you know, I have three young girls and I've spent a lot of time watching really interesting kids programs, including the Magic School Bus. And for anybody that's a fan of Miss Frizzle on the Magic School Bus, they've heard her say, take chances, get messy, make mistakes. And I've always thought that that really should be a great mantra for everyone. And so when you go out there and make big bets and it doesn't work, I think it's really learning what was it that doesn't work and being honest about what didn't work. And a lot of times there's some ego involved in some assumptions that were made and being honest about that. And then using that to change how you make future decisions is really the most important thing.
Our next clip is with Walter Driver, the co-founder and CEO of Scopely. Scopely is a mobile game company who's created some of the highest grossing games on the planet. In fact, they recently crossed the $2 billion mark in lifetime revenue for their game Monopoly Go. So, I have this new book coming out in June. It's called How Leaders Learn, and you can pre-order it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, or wherever you buy books, and it'll show up on your doorstep the day it's released. And the big idea of this book is that if you want to be successful, you have to become a learner. And what I love about Walter's leadership is he's a leader who's done just that. Here's a clip from episode 171 where Walter talks about turning your company into a learning machine.
It's a very fast-moving TAM, and we thought the most dynamic and agile companies were going to be most successful. And to build a company that can change faster and learn faster than any other company in the space is, you know, something that really was a key objective for us. And we started saying at the, you know, relatively early on in the company lifecycle that we weren't trying to build a company, we were trying to build a learning machine. And that feeling that if we could learn faster than any other company in our industry, that ultimately we would come out ahead over time because that knowledge would compound. And if we were just learning, you know, 3% faster than anybody else, we would end up in an amazing place. And that it attracted, you know, the kinds of people who are very open-minded about the specific tactics, but I think inspired by the mentality. And that enabled us to, I think, evolve very quickly and make a lot of tactical pivots when we needed to and seize new opportunities while still having this through line of, you know, how we thought about the company itself as a learning machine.
This next clip is from Joe Scarlett, the former CEO of Tractor Supply. Joe was in leadership at Tractor Supply for 3 decades, and in that time, he and his team experienced some incredible growth. Today, Tractor Supply has over 2,200 stores, 50,000 team members, and in 2023, they did almost $15 billion in sales. What you're about to hear is how getting clear about who their core customer is, who they call a hobby farmer, made all the difference. Here's a clip from episode 176.
When Tom Hennessy and I and the three of us took over running the company, was not doing well. We were in trouble. We were trying to figure out what's right. So we all spent a lot of time in the stores. We talked to customers. We talked to our employees. We talked to our managers. We even talked to the truck drivers. And we were observing what's going on and paying attention to what's going on. What we found is that although most of the vehicles outside were pickup trucks, there were not many farmers in the store. There were people there. Maybe 10% or 15% of the customers were farmers, but there were lots of other people. They were buying stuff. So we also were fortunate to be, we were data rich. We have a lot of information. So we could study what's selling, how many items we're selling, how much we're making on it, where it's selling geographically. And what we found pretty quickly was that the product that related to production agriculture was at best flat, and most of the products were declining in sales. But all these other products that were not, you wouldn't think of necessarily as farm products, were growing and growing, some of them growing pretty quickly. Anything with a gasoline engine on it, riding lawnmowers, push mowers, tillers, snow blowers, generators, other things like air compressors and specialized hardware and truck toolboxes, men's work clothing, pet food was on fire, animal feed was beginning, bird feeding, all these categories that were not tied directly to production agriculture were growing. We came to the conclusion after a while that this really is not a farmer we have, this is somebody else. And we tagged the name Hobby Farmer on there. It made all the difference in the world. It changed the trajectory of the company, changed the trajectory of how we bought product, what kind of product we're going to buy. It changed where we put stores. No more stores in the cornfields of Iowa. We put them where there are large numbers of hobby farmers, and we figured out how to define a hobby farmer. Hobby farmer is typically a full family unit, not dependent on agriculture for a living, could come from any walk of life. They could be doctors or lawyers or factory workers or school teachers. They always have dogs and cats. They usually have other animals, chickens or goats or horses or cows or something like that. They have a tractor probably. They have a barn or a shed. And this is their lifestyle. And the more we learned about that customer, the more we just marketed to that customer. That customer, for example, you and I probably go out for a steak dinner on Saturday night, but our customer is more likely home feeding the animals and repairing the fences. That's their lifestyle. And once we went hell-bent for election after that customer, it changed the dynamics of the business. It changed who we hired, where we put stores, what hours we're open, how we advertised, what we advertised, who we advertised to, put us on an entirely different path. And our competitors, although they had a lot of the same customers, they continued, for the most part, to think about themselves as marketing to farmers, because that's how the company was founded.
The next clip and our final clip in this best of quarter one episode is arguably my favorite 90 seconds from any of the podcasts we've ever done. It's my interview with Deion Sanders, who these days is known as Coach Prime, as he's leading the turnaround at the University of Colorado. My conversation with Deion happened just 10 days after the passing of my beautiful wife, Wendy. And so I asked him for a little bit of coaching for myself and my daughter, and this is the advice he gave me. To hear the entire episode, go back and listen to episode 178. And I got to tell you, this entire episode is one of my favorites. Deion, I mentioned before we even went on the show that I just lost my wife just last Saturday.
Yes, sir.
And you're obviously a man of faith. You know, I follow you on X. You already mentioned God several times on this conversation that we're having. I'd like to get some coaching from you, for myself and my daughter, on how we should handle the loss of the person we love more than anything.
Man, you know what? That's a great, great, authentic question, and I love it. First and foremost, I would treasure the moments. I would articulate the moments back and forth. I lost my pastor a few years back. I just called his wife a few days ago and just say, you remember the time? So we regurgitate these moments and we savor these moments. We don't put them aside and we get all the tears out whenever we want to. Ain't nothing wrong with a grown man or a grown woman crying. Ain't nothing wrong with that at all. We get out those emotions and then we're thankful. for the time. Because you never know that God could have taken them much earlier. He could have taken them for something else, but it was this time because he felt like you were prepared, that you were strong enough, that she was vital enough that she could handle it and you could handle it. But he gave you so many moments that you would have never garnished in life if you wouldn't have had those days and those moments. So think of those things. See, I'm always thinking positive, man. I don't have a bad day ever in life. I may have a bad moment, a bad minute, a bad hour, but never a bad day. And think about all those wonderful moments that he gave you and treasure those.
David, that was so much fun getting to relive those episodes with you. What another incredible quarter of conversations. For those of you tuning in, if there's someone you know who would enjoy this episode or a team member that needs to hear one of these clips, take a minute and share it with them. Shoot them a quick text with a link to the episode and tell them why you wanted them to hear it. As you know, our mission at How Leaders Lead is to make the world a better place by developing better leaders. And if you carve out a little time with us each and every week, we'll help you build the confidence you need to lead well.
And if you haven't already, would you take a minute and leave a rating and review of our show? We read every single comment and want to know what you appreciate the most so we can do even more of that in the episodes to come. And any suggestions you think that we can use to make our show better, just let us know. And let me tell you one other thing. If you don't go to that app store like Kula asked you to and take advantage of our How Leaders Lead daily inspirations, you're missing out. And I think once you go there, you're going to want everyone on your team to listen to it too. We are getting absolutely rave reviews on our How Leaders Lead app because you get great insights in under 2 minutes every single day. Coming up next on How Leaders Lead is my conversation with Neil Blumenthal and Dave Gilboa, co-CEOs of Warby Parker.